Hello, friends. Welcome once again to the Perfectly Bound podcast. This is a podcast all about anything and everything comic books and comics related, brought to you by the Panel Jumper and Comics Dungeon. My name is Ben. With me, as always, is Chris Casso.
Hello.
Cole Hornaday.
Hey.
And Nicole Lamb.
Hey.
Well, hey. How is everybody? Uh-oh, Nicole stole Cole's greeting.
Actually,
I go, hey.
The inflection is almost, you know, she does it better than I bequeath it to her.
I'm just borrowing it. It's right there. You go.
No. She gave it back. Yeah, she just gave it back. Look at that.
I don't need it back now.
Actually, you do.
Now you got to make something new.
Darn it.
Hey, friends, we've been at this for a while, and it got me to thinking, every once in a while, I see a story online where so-and-so has left a title, or so-and-so has moved from one title to the other. That got me thinking about how long creative teams typically stay on comics, and what's the record holder, do we know, for a single person or a team to be on a comic?
So I've got a whole bunch of numbers. We may be comparing some here because I don't trust some of these.
I did a little bit of research myself.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the
original team longest record, Lee and Stan Kirby. They had 102 issues over 9 years.
Correct.
What I saw. Then Bendis and Bagley on Ultimate Spider-Man apparently broke it with 111 issues, but I've seen four numbers on that: 109, 111, and 115. And
I saw 115.
Else. Okay. So, yeah.
Now, well, I think that it's supposedly it's an unbroken run. Go ahead.
Well, so here's the interesting thing. A lot of people got really picky about the truncated time on Ultimate Spider-Man because they went bi-weekly and they shoved in like a lot of specials and stuff in there and the numbers. So it's like, how particular are you? Is it over course of years or number of issues or content? Because then somebody pointed out, well, Lone Wolf and Cub Saga is 8,700 pages.
Right.
That's pretty big.
Wow.
And then George Harriman, the creator of Crazy Cat, had 33 years with no assistance ? On top of that. But 33 years is pretty big. And Charles Schultz is 49 years on Peanuts.
And these are strips.
These are strips. So maybe you don't qualify those.
Yeah, but that's interesting because they're doing content every day.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. On the strips?
It's like a web comics situation where sometimes people update daily or a couple times a week or something
you're
like
talking about. Yeah, so there's a lot of range here. Azzarello and Risso's 100 Bullets made it to 100 issues with the exact same creative team. Mm-hmm. So they're like right on the cusp there of the Lee Kirby one.
Lee and Kirby were on what title again?
Fantastic Four.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so they created pretty much the entirety of the Marvel Universe within that 102-issue run.
Wow.
So Cerebus, I think, still holds claim for longest single creator.
He eventually was about midway through the run, Church and State, he was working with Gerard, who did his backgrounds.
I saw that credited at number 65.
Oh, okay. Oh, was it that soon?
Yeah, so 65 to 300 would be the team of Sim and Gerard, which actually then blows away the Bendis Bagley number.
Yeah. But everybody's also overlooking Eric Larson on Savage Dragon.
And he's about to hit 200.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
No, he's at... I saw it on the stand. It's like a 226.
Oh, I know he's hitting the big numbers. So it's either 250
and
might be.
I think he has drawn and written every issue with maybe a couple exceptions. I gave up on Savage Dragon
ago. Yeah.
But,
perhaps Eric Larson should.
Well,
he probably will.
Yeah. He's one of the... I mean, he and those guys at Image were like the Wunderkinds, but now they're the old guard, and they're the grumpy old men who are telling the kids to get off their lawns.
I wonder what that feels like.
Sergio Aragonés, if you take all the Grooves together, it's 150 issues. Now, that's a team effort because he usually has Mark Evanier with him and a bunch of colorists and other guys.
Right.
Stan Sakai has been doing Usagi for over 25 years.
Wow.
So that's a pretty good chunk.
Over 150 issues, I think.
If you put them all together, plus, you can throw in like one-shots and the crossovers. He's doing a new Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle Usagi crossover. Did you have any extra numbers?
No, you beat me to all the other ones.
I'm sorry.
But I think I think that there's something to be said for, you know, the consistency, but in some cases, you know, with say Kirby and Kirby and Lee, they were consistent, and but they were not telling the kind of comics where it was expansive in its dramatic scope. It's like these characters were not really evolving. Mm-hmm. What's impressive to me is, like, you know, say what you will about Dave Sim, but Cerebus didn't evolve, but his world did.
Right.
And I didn't read a lot. I only read like the first year and a half or two of Bendis's Spider-Man, but that character evolved and that world evolved.
Yeah, I think the only thing I would have liked to have been able to find more hard numbers on was, like, somebody said, like, well, if you took all the Dragon Ball Z, which was, like, exactly. One guy, yeah. There's, like, over 44 volumes in that one guy's work, and then, like, I'm reading Berserk, and that's 38 volumes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the manga stuff, I think, like, kind of blows a lot of the American numbers away pretty quickly.
In those cases, it's kind of hard to tell because they're studios.
Some of them are definitely
big
studios.
And they are aping one another's style to do that. Like, Kamui was the other one that I came across. It's like, you know, hundreds and hundreds of issues that we can't really nail down in the States.
Yeah.
But particularly Dragon Ball Z.
I was super impressed with the Lone Wolf and Cub number, though, that 8,700 pages. It's like, holy crap.
Yeah, that is amazing.
And it's beautiful artwork all the way through.
Well, but you know, Chris, in some panels it's just a sword swish.
That's okay.
Yeah.
That's a pretty sword.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
a good swish.
Yeah.
Does it True. Show when a team or a single author is spending a lot of time on one property?
When you say, does it show, what do you mean in particular?
Can you
that
tell series? That maybe they're following into a rut, that they're exploring the same Ooh, kind of storylines? Can you read a book that's in like year 6 or 7 of a team on a single property, and you go back and compare it to like the within the first year, and you're like, oh yeah, they're just getting lazy,
yeah.
or they've run out of ideas,
yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and you don't necessarily see that in long runs either. You can see, like, maybe somebody had a story arc in mind, and
within
then after that, they're like, oh.
Yeah. Okay, I would argue that's why I gave up on Savage Dragon.
Yeah.
Because I really liked Eric Larson, and I thought out of all the books that came with that initial wave of Image superhero stories, that one had the most stamina, and I got bored after about... I read it for like 4 years, though.
I think I made it past like 110 or something.
I have to go back and look. I
don't know. Yeah.
But I have no interest in going back.
Yeah.
You know, I haven't purged them. I keep thinking about, should I just purge them? Because does anybody care? But, you know, there could be that Savage Dragon movie, you guys. Everything's going to be worth so much. Yeah. Because, you know, that animated series of the Savage Dragon that opened so many collectible doors.
Oh, yeah.
And the action figure line and all that stuff.
All those
but I'm
toys.
Not being facetious. This is real.
Yeah.
Yeah. I never heard of the Savage Dragon cartoon.
Yeah, see, this is all real. And there was a Wildcats, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, boy, they're terrible.
Ugh.
Anyway, stamina.
Stamina.
Staying power.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I think you can see that a lot with writers at Marvel.
Yeah.
Because they tend to have, like, a writer on for a long time. Like, Bendis is always on Miles Morales, but the artist team might max up. Or, like, Hickman was on, like, Avengers and New Avengers and doing crossovers and doing Avengers World and all these other things. So, like, his body of work was actually pretty big, but he probably had rotating artists all the time because Marvel.
Yeah.
And, like, Dan Slott's had Spider-Man for so long and that kind of thing. So you see longevity for storytellers,
for
but
writers.
Not necessarily with, like, the teams together. So that's...
See, I'll be
numbers.
The impressive thing about the Bendis Bagley thing, even if you say, oh, it's truncated time, Bagley still had to draw all that crap.
Yeah.
And that man is a machine.
I think that should count.
Yeah.
I mean, if you pumped out those issues, they count.
They count. Yep. But on that's also the perfect example of does it show, because, you know, how many times does every character in the Bendis Spider-Man run says, oi, Gavalt, you know, or my Tokus.
Baba Booey.
Yeah, you know, yeah, Baba Booey. Galactus shows up, Baba Booey.
Baba Booey.
You know? It's like, okay.
Oh, you listen to Stern 2, huh? Yeah. From circa 2003. Okay, great.
Those waves must be hitting deep space right now. Okay.
Yeah. It's like, why not Zoidberg? And you're like, what's happening right now? I don't know.
So, shouldn't they be bouncing and coming back by now?
Yeah. That's why Thanos is coming to kill us.
Oh, it all makes so much sense.
Mm-hmm. All right. Cool. Well, longevity, that's a long time to work on one thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is.
Is all those many years and all those many issues. I got to wonder if, you know, if Bagley was the author, the artist.
Yeah.
I wonder if he just got tired of drawing Spider-Man over and over.
Before that run, He used to write, draw Amazing Spider-Man for like almost 5 to 10 years.
Jeez.
So like,
well, he knew how to do it really
he
well.
He knew how to do it. Yeah. So that he's actually an interesting cross-generational artist where there's a lot of fans over multiple generations that love him just because he's kind of, he was my first Spider-Man artist.
Yeah.
So I always have a like, oh, vaguely kind of thing. and then like he was, you know, a lot of people's favorite when they were old enough to, you know, when he was kind of new and they were in their 30s, you know? So that's kind of a cool thing.
Cool.
So, yeah.
All right. Thanks, y'all. Let's move on to our another topic today. And it kind of can dovetail into the longevity, which is unresolved. Now, this is about dangling plot lines and storylines that just never came to a proper close.
Did we kind of do this a while back?
I think
we've touched on it before.
Because I'm looking at notes here, and I'm like, I remember talking about this, and I don't think I dreamed it.
And we've also mentioned a number of times, depending on what's come up, about things like the Frankenstein Alive Alive we've mentioned a bunch of times, and stuff like that kind of thing.
It's gonna be an ongoing discussion.
Yeah.
It always happens.
I think one of the things that it's similar was we were talking about, like, what happens when do characters just disappear? So that's kind of the same-ish realm, but this is I read this as a little more specific
because I took a couple of notes, but I'm like, I think I've talked about so are you talking, Ben, are you talking about books or plots?
Anything.
Or okay,
yeah, I'm not keeping it to one specific.
All right, because I can't remember if we talked about Warren Ellis and Ben Temple Smith's Fell.
I don't think, maybe not in detail, maybe in passing.
I think
but
we
yeah.
lamented it.
Yeah. Probably. It's always because lamenting. It's,
I remember this in case. Fell is a really fascinating comic book. It ran 9 issues. It started in 2005 and ran until 2008. And it came out sporadically because it's Warren Ellis. But it's this homicide detective in this strange kind of surreal township. And there's every issue is kind of standalone, but there's a subplot.
There's a thread that goes through because he's on this other side of town and you kind of want to figure out what his past, what happened.
And it's hard to tell. And there are moments where you kind of even wonder if everybody in this story is actually living.
Mm-hmm.
Because Temple Smith, he's a really brilliant painter artist. He did, the original 30 Days of Night graphic novel, and I just don't get to see enough of his work anymore.
Well, Wormwood is coming back.
Wormwood is,
I think.
That, okay,
the Gentleman
I didn't do
Wormwood.
A good job of following that one, but
that's okay.
I remember seeing him at a comic book show. Maybe you and I were together.
Three piece suit, always a gentleman.
Yeah, always. But I walked up to him and I said, you know, what's the story on Fell and when is it coming back? And I think I was probably the 120th person that day who'd asked him that
in the last
asinine
hour.
Question.
Yeah.
Did he punch you in the stomach?
Well, he rolled his eyes. God bless him, you know. And I think that was him being British and gentlemen.
I think when I met him, somebody ahead of me was talking about it, and he goes, well, when I get the scripts, I'll draw the material.
So, and I would have that in mind when I was taking this note that he said in a 2013 interview that there's one issue done, and I could have it illustrated tomorrow, and Image won't print it. And they won't do that because it's been such a long lag time. They don't think that it would be.
Oh, there's no incentive to just
no
do an issue.
To solicit it. Yeah. Yeah. They'd need.
They'd have to repackage it probably.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Which is something we should probably consider talking about down the road is what the death knell of repackaging, a death knell of a story when it comes to repackaging. Mm-hmm. All right. Enough of my talking. Chris?
Did you have anything?
Nicole?
I had the story Bedlam because while it did technically end in volume 2, it left all of the plot lines just dangling like loose threads.
Can you remind me what that was?
So Bedlam was taking this sort of Joker archetype who was a serial killer, and he gets this like black market lobotomy and is sort of fixed and decides that he's going to help the police department to try to solve another serial killer crime that's happening. Mm-hmm. There's these strange things and there's this supernatural thing happening, and they never really describe what that is. So, yeah, there's like other superhero vigilante people showing up and they have connections.
This is not ringing a bell. What publisher was it?
It was Image. Okay. And it was Riley Rossmo, who he does a number of horror things. He did the Green Wake series that I really like.
Oh, yeah.
Which did that one did Green round Wake. Out. But yeah. What was it? The one, the Bad Blood? Did he do the illustration on Bad Blood, or is that somebody like him?
I think that was him.
Yeah. 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 But anyway, that was one that it just, I was like, I wonder when the next issue's coming out. And I was like, there is no next issue. And I think it was either canceled or they just decided to call it. I don't really know what the story ended up being on that, but I remember other people coming in and being like, yeah, when's the next one coming out? I'm like, it's not. It's over. And they're
hate
like, what?
To be the bearer of bad news.
So it's hard for me to actually recommend that, even though like I think volume one is really solid. Mm-hmm. Volume two just sort of like there's nothing else after that. Yeah.
And of course the one that I whine about all the time is Xenozoic Tales, Catalogs and Dinosaurs. Because the last issue of that was 14, and that was in 1996. And it was right in the middle of a storyline. And just Mark Schultz apparently has no passion for it anymore. Mm. Because that was self-published, and he has the fan base for someone to be, you know, he wouldn't need to repackage it as far as I'm concerned. But maybe that's what he's thinking. At any rate, it's been so long that it's, and he will tease, you know, saying that he's going to come back at it again. And he says that every couple of years. The other terrible one was Alan Moore and Bill Sienkiewicz's Big Numbers. Mm-hmm. And that one was, you know, now it's become kind of mythic because it only ran two issues. Sienkiewicz drew a third issue that never saw publication, but actually Xeroxes of it wound up on eBay. Mm-hmm. And then there was a fourth issue that was drawn by Sienkiewicz's protege, Al Columbia, and apparently in Columbia's everything I've ever heard about him, I have a couple of his books. They're really valuable because they're so underrun. But he's apparently a nut burger, and he burned all of his original artwork for issue four. Nice. And I can imagine, you know, if you set off someone who's emotionally Alan Moore can be quite adept at setting people off, and he probably set this man off, and the guy burned all his artwork. But yeah, part of the problem with that one is that it was a weird format. Do you guys remember this book?
Mm-mm.
It could have been Alan Moore's Ulysses. It was about this little town, and they're building a shopping mall, and it's just about all these people's very simple working class lives. And it was not a big story, but it was a big story about very simple things. And it was beautifully done, but it had this format that was like
treasury size?
Yeah, 15 inches wide by like 10 inches high. So it's not going to fit in any boxes. It's not going to fit on any shelves. And I think they had the first issue was through one publishing company. The second issue was through, Mad Love, and then it got picked up by Eastman's Tundra, and it's just really frustrating. And I got rid of them, and now those back issues are going for like 50, 60 bucks.
Of course. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anyway, enough of my talking.
How about you, Chris?
Spend the rest of your life saying things like that.
You gotta stop getting rid of
comics, Cole.
you guys know that I've been in this purging process, right?
Yeah. Like,
you know, and I'm cleaning out the comic room, and I'm... Yeah, it's a struggle for me, people. The struggle is real.
If any one of y'all could misery a comic creator to just lock them in a room and continue a storyline, what would it be? And of course, I'm referring to Stephen King's novel Misery, where Kathy Bates locks mm-hmm. James Caan in a room mm-hmm. To finish his novel.
I got it.
Well, before we do that, let's give Chris some time to say his stuff.
Yeah, I had a couple.
Go for it. You're going to say S.H.I.E.L.D., right?
No, well, that should happen.
Well, yeah.
But I took this question as specifically story arcs, mm-hmm. not just like a dead series. And so what I took was Geoff Johns did a run of the Avengers. That's one of my favorites. And he did a build-up. There was an old group of villains that nobody cared about called the Zodiac, which, as you can guess, different villain for each Zodiac sign. And he brought back one called Scorpio. And Scorpio used to be kind of not a pushover, but not a big deal. And he actually kidnapped the capital of every nation on the world and took the entire entire Avengers to a standstill. And they beat him, and at the dead end, he was like, okay, I'm going to bring everybody back. And they were going to develop a whole new Zodiac. Mm-hmm. And it was just like, this is going to be really cool. Never got back to it. Geoff Johns left Marvel, and they never got back to it. And there has since been some Zodiac stuff, but that's like 15 years later. So it's like, this story never got finished. Mm-hmm. And then back on Geoff Johns again, when he rebirthed The Flash, when he brought back Barry Allen, every time Geoff Johns finishes a story arc, he always has like upcoming previews of the future, mm-hmm. and they're really cool. And at the end of the series, he had it where the original Reverse Flash found the second Reverse Flash, and they were going to do like a really cool team-up thing. That never happened because New 52 happened. And then they also were going to do a thing where Wally West's children were supposed to become like this horrible plague on his life. New 52 wiped them out of continuity. Mm. So all these Geoff Johns stories, he was like, I'm going to meticulously set these all up. Mm. Oh, I've been New 52'd. so those were my sad story ones. But this is...
He's got a New 52'd tude.
Yeah.
There's your verb.
This one is a... this last...
See, actually...
actually. This last one is interesting just because it did technically finish, but it's in a really weird way. So if you'll humor me for a second. So the last issue of one of the earliest Aquaman series ended with the story called The Creature That Devoured Detroit. And it ended with Aquaman destroying a satellite that was causing a monster to threaten Detroit, but it lacked any denouement that suggested that Detroit was okay at the end of it. And then it just ends with an explosion in space, and the caption says, at that same instant, far from the surface of the Earth, and that was it. That's like the last issue of Aquaman for 6 years. The writer, Steve Skeets, had planned a second part to the story, and 3 years later, he finally told it in Submariner.
And yeah, I just think that is amazing.
Wow.
That cracks me up.
He replaced Arthur with Namor, right. And they went on with the plot as if nothing had happened. And oddly enough, the issue that completed the storyline in 1974 was the final issue of Namor. Mm-hmm. So the final issue of Aquaman and the final issue of Namor deal with a dangling plot line
right.
across that's one company or
how many
two
years?
Companies.
Three?
Three issues.
Well, how many years?
The second part of the story was 3 issues later. Yeah.
Oh, three between, issues later.
3 years later, sorry. Okay. Oh, between the two titles. Yeah, yeah.
Because you at one point had suggested I do a panel jumper right. about that. I'm still in the back of my mind trying to figure out how I can glue that together with something else.
Yeah, I don't know if there's enough there to be done for a full episode, but it's funny.
Yeah, I know. When we get so desperate, Ben and I get so desperate for stories. I'm trying to be nasty.
Hey, Chris, we're going to come to you when we're desperate.
That's okay, when you start doing the B-sides and rarities collection.
Most people do.
It would be one story in an episode of all kinds of little stories about these things.
Cool.
So, because I love the idea. My misery would be The Last Galactus Story by John Byrne.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was originally part of the Epic magazine anthology from the 80s, and it's never been finished. And it's not as though the Epic Illustrated got canceled before it could finish it. He just got busy with other projects and never got back to it. And then they eventually canceled it. And he talked about one time including it. Remember Marvel was doing the end stories mm-hmm. back. Was that the early aughts?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, the Punisher, the Punisher, the end, the
mm-hmm. Iron
the
Man end. End. Yeah. Yeah.
But he talked about including that as part of the end series. And I would like to see it because essentially what it deals with is the death of Galactus. Mm. And him being replaced by another world-consuming evil. And it was John Byrne, and John Byrne at the height of his skill as an artist and storyteller.
In the meantime, you could look at a golden Galactus that's helping other people out, Molecule Man, and things
Ultimates.
Are happening in space. It's exciting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is that what's, happening
bringer.
In your world, Nicole?
Yeah.
Nicole, do you have a misery comic? Do you have one where you just want to lock someone up and force them to finish it?
Not particularly. I mean, there is the Helena Rose that Emmett Comics was publishing. Their one issue came out. Everyone fell in love with it. It was a really great thing. And I'm like, wow, it's been so long since that came out. And they're like, yep, never going to happen again. I'm like, oh, okay.
Right.
So I kind of would like to just maybe time machine and just make it just never happen, actually.
Nah. take a forget me
just,
now.
Just for yeah.
It actually makes me sad because I have approached a lot of artists about projects, what's ever become of that, and have them just say flat out, nope, not going to happen.
Yeah, just done.
Mike Mignola's amazing screw on head. It was like this one shot he did, mm-hmm. and they did an animated film of it, which is
it was
terrific.
Great. Yeah.
And I was like, is there going to be any more? He's like, nope.
Yeah.
Nope. Yeah. And I don't think he realized how much he hurt me.
No. What about you, Chris? Do you have one?
A misery comic?
I probably would basically force like Geoff Johns to like rewrite the entirety of like DC as if New 52 didn't happen. Just create like let's just make another just like Earth Johns. just act as if none of that happened and finish all those plots.
Yeah, that would be
because
cool.
He had like I'm gonna guess he had more than a couple dozen of those floating like to happen in the future previews where he had an artist draw something where they would show like a villain. Like there's one where they showed Lex Luthor beating up Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman, screaming he was my son, and it was about those basically hinting at like the death of Superboy. And it's just like, they never did it. You know, it's like, I wanted to see that. I like the idea that Lex Luthor kind of got really, really emotional about the death of his clone baby, you know, things like that. So yeah, just give me Earth Johns.
And all right.
No editorial.
But you didn't mention Hickman's Shield.
Yeah, it's going to happen.
You think
eventually.
It's gonna happen?
Oh, they've shown the scripts, the artist receiving the scripts.
Oh, really?
It's just that it doesn't fit anywhere now. So I think Marvel's kind of sitting on it. They're like, we don't know what to do with it now. Mm. It doesn't fit into continuity or at the moment. They're probably just going to re-release the whole thing as a finished volume, I hope.
Although, what was the Nostradamus stuff popping up? Was that in Secret Empire?
That was in Secret Empire. They took some of that stuff and
they took some of it
shoved it in there.
It in there. So, just strange, yeah.
Okay.
All right. Well, that's unresolved, and those are our misery comics. If any of these creators go missing, we had nothing to do with it. Let's move on to Book Report,
proof.
Friends. And for Book Report, hey, Cole Hornaday, let's start with you, sir. What do you got for us?
Well, as I have been going back and making concerted effort to read older comics that that passed by so long ago, I don't even remember reading them. But a couple weeks ago, we did the episode about, or we discussed Elseworlds books, and I made the point that there are very few Elseworlds books from my recollection that are not about Superman and Batman. But Chris, I believe, pointed out, because I think it's one of his favorite books, was The Golden Age. It was an Elseworlds story about the World War II legacy DC characters. And it was written by James Robinson and Paul Smith. So I broke these out and I reread them. And they hold up surprisingly well. Essentially, the plot is, you know, what has become of all the Golden Age superheroes who fought in World... Mystery Men who fought in World War II, and what happens to them after the war is over. So this takes place immediately after World War II. Some of them are rather broken, like...
Starman,
and Manhunter. And it's covers four Perfect Bound. What? Perfect Bound.
Hey, that's the name of the show.
That's right. issues. And I, fortunately, it was so long ago that this was published. This was published back in 1992 that I have no memory of it. And James Robinson was one of my favorite writers. Paul Smith was one of my favorite illustrators. And it is quite lovely. I had a good time rereading it. I don't want to give too much of the plot away because there is a twist at issue 3 that I think is significant that I had not Chris reminded me of it in the last episode, I would have forgotten of who the bad guy turns out to be. It's wonderful because James Robinson and Paul Smith are creators who have kind of been forgotten in the last 20 years, or at least didn't actualize their potential. Robinson's still working. Of course, he was doing Scarlet Witch, and what's the other book he's written for DC?
DC? He was doing Justice League years ago, but he did The Invaders for Marvel not too long ago.
And that was, I heard that was just terrible.
Yeah, I didn't care about it. Yeah.
But... No, his run on Justice League was unforgivable.
But there's a lot of editorial, but that's a whole other thing.
It's not his fault.
Yeah.
It's not his fault, but I don't have a good memory of his work on it.
Gotcha.
What I wanted to say was these are two creators whose potential was indicated in this series and the like of which has never happened since, as far as I can recall. Paul Smith's artwork, to me, is on a par with Will Eisner. In fact, I think he was aping a lot of Eisner-esque styles, and the colors and the inking is just really, really gorgeous. It's frequently reprinted, but I don't think it's been reprinted of late.
There's a brand new hardcover that just came out.
All right. You know what? I recommend that you get your hands on this.
Yeah.
I think it's well worth your time because it depicts these rather cellophane and superficial World War II characters with a great deal more depth and gravitas. And I thoroughly enjoyed rereading it, and I'm glad I did it.
Cool. Yeah. All right. Wow. 92 was 25 years ago.
And I was like, why don't I remember reading this? Well, I was en route to graduate school and settling into a new life out in the Midwest. And I had a new girlfriend and I just don't remember a lot of what happened.
And then. It was 25 years ago.
And it was 25 years ago.
It was in 92. Right. Let me double check on the date here. 93, yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
The Golden Age, 24 years ago.
Yeah,
thank you, Cole.
You're welcome.
Nicole, what do you got for us?
So sometimes we get promotional books to read, and I have reviewed some of those on here. We just got something from Scholastic. It's the new Babysitter's Club, Volume 5. This is where there will be a departure from Raina Telgemeier, who has been doing the series up until this point. Gail Callaghan is going to be doing it, and it's based off of the novels by Anne M. Martin. She started the Babysitter's Club original novel series in 1986, and it had a TV show, it had films, if you're not familiar with Babysitter's Club at all.
I remember the film.
Yeah, and, you know, there's always, like, I've talked about this in the last podcast, where there's always, like, types of girls, you know, right. Like, there's the tomboy, and the Babysitter's Club obviously has those, like, lady tropes. But it's always, like, these girls aged 11 to 13 who are usually confronting some sort of common problems, like illness or sibling rivalry, peer conflicts, and parents' divorce and remarriage. This one, it's called Dawn and the Impossible 3, does deal with divorce and remarriage as like a central theme to the book. And it was really, really good. So Dawn is the main protagonist in this one. She just moves from California to this fictional Stony Brook, Connecticut, where she has hooked up with the Babysitter's Club and is a very well-seasoned babysitter. So she goes to this one house where there's these three kids and a very, very, very hectic mom who's like running out of the door, not even like saying a few words. The house is a total disaster. The kids are kind of rambunctious, but you know, she's got this. So she's like, let's make a game of everything and let's clean the house as fast as we can. And she falls, she gets the kids to really like her. And in the meantime, Christy, who is the leader of the group, she's about to move on like the other side of the town into this mansion because her mother's getting remarried. And then Dawn's mother is starting to date. God, this is sounding like a journal entry. But yeah.
Dawn, dear diary.
I know, dear diary. Marianne said this and then that happened. So yeah, another one of her friend's father is dating her mom and they had gotten divorced. And so anyway, back to the family with the three kids. The mother is running around and you find out that like, there's something weird with the dad. Like, if there's a phone call, don't say that I'm gone. You know, like, don't let the kids speak to them. And it's just kind of like, ooh, what's going on with this dad? Like, this is kind of shady.
Psycho dad.
Well, I thought, like, maybe he's dangerous. Maybe something. And I'm like, wow, this is pretty,
Russian
like...
spy dad.
This is pretty, like, kind of deep for, like, an all-age material. But it turns out that it's just, like, a really bad divorce. Their custody battles are really not going very, very well. And they're not communicating. And the thing that I really love about this book is that each main protagonist girl tends to have to not only confront a common problem, but also find a way to be accountable, responsible, step up to the plate. And I really appreciate that because there's a lot of, you know, people letting themselves off the hook and that kind of thing. And I think having the central theme of like integrity, accountability, responsibility, what is your responsibility in this sort of situation? Because Dawn does step up in a big way in this book. So I think that It's a very good series. I was never really interested in the Babysitter's Club when I was a kid. It was never really, I don't know, it seemed almost too girly or something for me. But now it's hitting home, and I think because of the themes and the writing, very compelling. I think that it is certainly an all-age material. If any kids are dealing with like divorce or remarriage or anything like that, it could be a really good book for them to read. Not them personally dealing with divorce and remarriage, but anyway, yeah. But I mean, I think that it could hit home for them. Like, I think the Roller Girl series that I've rave about is something like talking about accountability as well as a young person, and growing up and how difficult that can be and having to step into that. And I think it just fits really well in that whole genre of slice of life and Raina Telgemeier and growing up and all that. So I highly recommend this. This book will be released September 27th. You can pre-order it now. And if you want to get into any of the Babysitter's Club volumes previously, they're all self-contained and they usually focus on a different protagonist. So
cool.
Yeah.
Excellent.
All right. Thank you, Nicole. Mm-hmm. And finally, Chris, what do you got for us?
Have either of you guys ever like thought of what you're going to say ahead of time to the point where you're like, I already thought I gave my review?
Yeah.
Wow. That, no, Chris, oh, okay. But yes, I love the
go
image.
To the tape.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So,
go to the brain tape.
Or it could be that this is such a small comic.
Half a comic.
So I read The Hero Denied, Mage. This is the final, the beginning of the final trilogy of Matt Wagner's Mage series.
Interjection. You want to talk about tying up loose ends, brother,
yeah,
right here.
I mean, that last run was in the late 90s.
I do believe.
Yeah. So I'm going to start this off with the fact that this is a 12-page comic for $2.
Wow.
I don't like that. There's no ads, so there's that.
But we like that.
Yeah, but it's a fast read for $2. He needed to do this for $1.
You could have bought an issue of Saga for 50 cents.
Yeah,
because
yeah,
they had that
seriously,
deal.
The special, yeah.
Yeah.
I did really, really like all the Mage stuff, but enough time's gone by that it's lost its luster for me. Mm. And it starts very meta. The main character, Kevin Matchstick, is waiting in some dilapidated warehouse area, and there's like another hero that comes up to him and says like, hey man, oh, what you been up to? I haven't seen you in a long time. Where you been? And he's just like, oh, this and that here and there. So he's like summing up the career of the writer and the artist as well. And then it just kind of gets into a quick super introduction of what the style of the book's going to be. I'm not going to give too much spoilers because Cole still needs to read it. But it's just kind of a taste of the tone. And it still has like a good sense of humor and all that to it. But it feels a little dated to me. Like he introduces a character that I think is supposed to be him being like, oh, millennials. Mm-hmm. But it's a guy who's very 90s, not millennials. It's a guy who's
he's
like,
got a chain wallet and Jankos.
It's the guy who's like on a skateboard, and he's kind of like, dude, radical. His name's the Stees. And he's like, the Stees opens up with a half pipe. And I'm just like,
he starts like pumping his sneakers because he's about to play some basketball.
Exactly. Oh, he's got his Air Jordans. All right. Yeah.
So it's just sort of like, huh, this is a weird.
Mayhap, it is a character that is trapped in time.
I don't know about
Gen
that.
X Men.
Yeah.
Oh, Gen X-Men. Nice. Nice.
So it's a little bit of a weak prelude to me. That's sure. All it is. It's a prelude of like reminding people like, hey, this is a thing. Mm-hmm. It's a number zero, so it probably shouldn't give it the weight you should give a number one. It's just that $2 price tag makes me a little angry. Mm-hmm. But whatever.
It's $2.
I know. I count page numbers on a lot of
but
books.
But also, issue from Image would be $3.50. So that's not even half price with the half comic, right? Because it is an Image title. So it's more than half the price of a full comic. Yeah.
So that's a minor thing. If you're a collector of the Mage stuff, that's, you know, it is just $2. Mm-hmm. So there's that. And it's not even like the start of a plot. It's just like a reminder of who Kevin Matchstick is without really telling you too much about him.
So they could have easily just put that at the beginning of the next series.
Yeah. That's what I think that's where I'm mostly like, come on, guys, condense a bit.
But this
yeah.
is Wagner's MO. When he was gearing up to do the second Mage series, it was a couple of years in coming. There were short two or three page episodes in the back of Grendel, which were the same kind of thing. And I remember it being pretty anticlimactic buildup because I am a big Matt Wagner fan, mm-hmm. you guys. Mm-hmm. I not necessarily of his writing, but of his writing and illustration. I mean, I have he's signed the back of my leather jacket that has.
Oh, Grendel. Is that that guy?
That's that guy.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah,
I know who you're talking
yeah.
about.
Yeah, I'm a big fan, and I'm a big fan of Mage because I, you know, have had at one time or another that Thunderbolt T-shirt. Mm-hmm. Anyway, but I can't really speak to this yet because I haven't read yeah. it. I am looking forward to it, but I'm also not expecting it to blow open any doors for me.
I like your counter review. Yeah. I will say his art looks great. Yeah, it's Matt Wagner.
He doesn't draw a lot anymore.
No, he does a lot of covers.
Yeah.
Yeah. yeah. And he does a little bit of writing here and there. So, I mean, he's refining himself over the years. Mm-hmm. So it does look great. It does look like solid Matt Wagner. And if you like that, you will like this, I think.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
So, yeah.
All right. Cool. Thank you, Chris. And that is Book Report, and that is our show. And coming up is Quiz Time. But before we go, I want to tell you that the Perfect Bound podcast is brought to you by The Panel Jumper. See everything Cole Hornaday and I do at thepaneljumper.com and Comic Extension here at 319 Northeast 45th Street in beautiful downtown Wallingford, or 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at comicsengine.com. Find us online at perfectboundpodcast.com. Send us an email, perfectboundpodcast@gmail.com, where you can send us quiz questions, which is what time it is now. Get your quiz hats on, everybody. And this week, our questions come to us from Mr. Cole Hornaday. Lay it on us, Cole.
Wait, what?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
quiz time.
Oh, I tried to do a mind mess on you and I failed. All right, this quiz time.
Out.
I tried to fake bake you out, brother. This quiz time is called "It's a bit dead around here," or "Your plot is a lot filled with a lot of familiar plot."
Well.
These questions pertain to urban fantasy characters, in some cases comics and some not, who benefit from a reduced cost of living and are spared a stultifying association with neighborhood associations because, yes, they reside in cemeteries. You ready for this? Okay. Mm. This is this 1940s era mess. Vigilante resides in a cat-filled mausoleum in Wildwood Cemetery while fighting crime in the timeless metropolis of Central City. Please name this mess crime fighter.
Spirit?
That's right. Will Eisner's Spirit, a.k.a. Denny Colt. The Spirit was created by cartoonist Will Eisner. I just said that. And he first appeared in June of 1940. Located in Eugene, Oregon, Gwen Dillon is just a regular girl, but she needs to eat a brain every once in a while, every once a month or so. She needs to eat a brain once a month to keep from losing her memories and intelligence. As a gravedigger, she has plenty of access to recently deceased peoples. And when she consumes their brains, she inherits part of the deceased's thoughts. Please name this comic.
iZombie.
There would be iZombie, created by Chris Robertson and Mike Allred. iZombie was first published by Vertigo Comics in 2010, and then later a very successful TV series on CW, now in its third season, and it first aired in 2014. The lineup of the TV series changed considerably. Gwen is no longer Gwen. She's now called Liv. Liv Moore.
Oh.
Which I kind of thought was cute. Yeah, and she keeps an apartment, not a vault, as her home. In the TV version, she's an assistant to the county coroner, but she still eats brains and adopts her personality traits of dead people.
Well, good, because I was really going to question this
yeah.
thing. No, brains?
Yeah. I've seen the first season of iZombie, and I actually really liked it. Mm-hmm. It's very CW, but she, the actress...
That kind of works for it, right?
The actress who plays Liv is quite charming, and I got an action figure of her last name. Anyway, one of Neil Gaiman's most fascinating young adult characters is the orphan nobody, Bod Owens. Bod, short for nobody. Bod is the only flesh and blood mortal residing in a cemetery where he was raised by ghosts, a vampire, and a werewolf. Please name the novel that has been adapted to a graphic novel and a soon-to-be feature film.
I used to know this.
I don't know, graveyard books or something?
Yes, yeah. The graveyard book.
Yeah.
You guys have read I just guessed book? Because it's a graveyard book. I haven't read any Neil Gaiman.
Oh, you guys. The graveyard book is the best. Graveyard book is published in 2008 and later a two-part graphic novel, which I've not ever read, actually, featuring art by Craig Russell, Kevin Nolan, Tony Harris, Scott Hampton.
Yeah, a lot of people. Yeah.
A horror comedy comic, this series begins when Michael Paris, an ordinary young man, inherits a plot of land upon his grandfather's death, located in a town called Raven's Hollow. Paris thinks he's just going to pick up the check for the land, and he finds that the land is actually the town graveyard. To his surprise, the graveyard is not empty, but full of active supernatural occupants. Can you name the comic?
This is Richard Moore, isn't it?
This is Richard Moore.
Oh.
I notebook. I own it. I don't.
It's called Boneyard.
Yeah.
Okay.
Richard Moore, published by NBN Publishing, ran 28 issues from 2001 to 2009, is currently on hiatus. I have never read the comic. Lastly, this Italian comic book was about a penniless vegetarian nightmare investigator and his sidekick, Groucho, and has been translated to not only one but two films and still one of the biggest sellers in its home country. Can you name the comic?
I carried it.
Yep.
And it starred, didn't the movie star the guy who was Superman?
Yep.
Richard Dog? No.
Dylan Dog. Created by Tiziano Scalvi, was originally published in 1986. Sadly, my familiarity with the initial film adaptation over the comic book has just made me a liar, because the comic book is not set in a graveyard. Dylan and Groucho actually live on 7 Craven Road in a cluttered apartment where the doorbell screams. But he does live in a cemetery in the movie, and there's two in Cemetery Man, which I highly recommend. Was made, it's an Italian film made in 1994. He resides in the cemetery, and he and his weird little sidekick bludgeon or stop the corpses from rising and putting them back underground. Mm-hmm. And then the film, the American film in 2001, had Brandon Routh in it, who was from Superman Lives. Mm-hmm. And that was called Dylan Dog, Dead of Night. Both films I thoroughly enjoyed. Mm-hmm. I think actually the Dylan Dog movie is not too shabby. And in 1999, Dark Horse Comics adapted several stories of Dylan Dog in a 6-issue miniseries with very, very super cool covers by Mike Mignola.
Mm-hmm. All right, cool. Thank you, Cole. That actually reminds me of something interesting I learned recently. I always thought cemetery and graveyard were interchangeable words, but cemetery refers to a large plot of land not associated with a church. A graveyard is a small plot of land that is associated with a church. It's part of the churchyard.
Huh.
So a graveyard is a graveyard is next to a church, and a cemetery is not.
That's great. Yeah, but how about a boneyard?
A boneyard?
Whoa.
You got
all
other
bets
problems.
Are off.
Other problems if you're talking about a boneyard. All right, thank you, Cole. That is our show. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.